Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland with you live in our Buck studio here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We also have an audience. It's, I think, going to get pretty lively at times because the conversation is going to be lively, and so is the playing on the instrument being a fortepiano. And the fortepianist, my guest today, as he has been before, Trevor Stevenson. Welcome.
Pleasure. Hi.
Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here in the Buck studio.
And you've brought a friend.
I brought a friend. We traveled here yesterday by caravan. Actually by van only, right. So this is a 18th century style forte piano, but this is only 10 years old. It was built here in Madison by Norman Shepherd. And this is Mozart's concert instrument. This is what he dragged around with him through Vienna to play his concerts. This is what Haydn played his operas, in the pit on, this type of thing. And even Beethoven, this is really what he knew up to the time he went deaf when he was about 30 years old. This is
the last keyboard sound he would have heard.
Yeah,
it's
piano. 150 pounds of loveliness instead of 700 pounds of loveliness, like its modern descendant.
So speaking of the context of these keyboards, mm-hmm. we start at the very, very beginning with what? Like a virginal or a clavichord,
well,
and then work our way
there
up?
There were all sorts of plucked keyboard instruments from the Renaissance up through the High Baroque, which we now call, generally harpsichords, virginals, harpsichords, and other things, and they were chamber instruments for people to sing with, or to the cellist to work with, and people made music with these keyboard instruments for 300 or 400 years. But in the middle of the 18th century, this new beast came on the scene by way of Italy, by way of a fellow named Cristofori, who took one of his harpsichords, pulled the action out, the plucking mechanism, and replaced it with hammers that strike the string, right? Which, the hammer of revolution, kind of. And by striking the string, a whole bunch of things changed. You lose that incredibly pristine sound of the pluck of the harpsichord, but you gain dynamics, forte in piano, which is why they called it the forte piano. You could play loud and soft, right? And you also gain a kind of like a more heft to the sound. I mean, it's a beefier, thicker sound.
Made a lot of crows happy, too.
Right. And then suddenly the bird feathers were not needed anymore, but although leather was now brought into the scene. So all the hammers here are covered with buckskin, which is the material they use to make this sound. We'll look at the action later, but the skin, the buckskin, by being a skin, it gives the sound kind of a very precise beginning.
So what was the incentive for going from harpsichord to the fortepiano is because we're playing for larger audiences and larger halls, public concerts?
I think so. It does carry farther than a harpsichord sound. It also, by bringing this dynamic realm to the keyboard, which was not possible at the harpsichord. I mean, this is, the shadings of loud and soft and everything in between, controlled by your touch, is what this instrument could do. That was its innovation, and people wanted it. And they were, by the end of the 18th century, really willing to give up a lot of the harpsichord's clarity for this world. And I don't know if they looked at it quite as a trade-off at the time. They really had both. They had harpsichords and forte pianos, but in marketing, this won out, and the harpsichord disappeared throughout the 19th century. So it's kind of interesting.
And it's, unlike the harpsichord, the forte piano really isn't an accompaniment instrument anymore in an orchestral context.
Right, not as part of the band anymore. It was lovely with the voice. And in fact, one of the first things that the Italians said when they invented this forte piano was, it sounds great with the human voice. They really liked it. But then it becomes a soloistic instrument. Again, this is what Mozart would have played his concertos on and things like that. And then this, in the early 19th century, puts on about 600 pounds of weight, and becomes the modern piano and becomes a soloistic instrument for a large hall with hundreds, if not thousands, of people in it. Yeah.
It had a window.
Right. Then the window for this is probably from the 1760s up to about 1800. This instrument, because of its lighter frame and small hammers and all that, it speaks much quicker than the modern piano. It's lighter on its feet. It's, kind of a Fred Astaire type of thing, it moves very easily. And all these fine articulations that Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven wrote in tirelessly, these small slurs that are all over their music are rendered quite easily on the forte piano just because of its tonal envelope. You'll hear the sound. It blooms quickly, it dies quickly, and it can be feathered. Each note can be feathered into the succeeding one. Yeah.
What about those pedals?
The pedals, I know, and it's on camera, I don't know if we can see that, but there are no pedals here, but there is a knee lever. So when I lift my knee, then the sound sustains, and if I let go of my knee, then the sound stops. This is the way the instrument was in the late 18th century. People fell in love with this sound, the pedaled sound so much, where everything is sustained, that they the makers eventually said, okay, if you're going to ride the thing all the time, we'll give it to your foot. You know, so they make a foot pedal that goes with it. The very earliest forte pianos had a little stop out here on the side. You would pull the stop and all the dampers would be released. You'd play like a hammer dulcimer for a while, everything ringing, and then you would put it back and then it would be dry again. So this is the middle.
Yeah. How about some music?
Let's do some music. I thought we'd just start with a kind of a dance. This is a very short piece by Carl Maria von Weber, a little Allemande, and you can hear almost the gloved applause of the dance floor on this. And probably Jane Austen's world is very close to this, early 19th century. And then I'm going to just segue into a Schubert Écossaise in B minor. Definitely from the dark side. Yeah, it's right. Yeah, B minor always being a very haunted key. And then from there, just another very short Schubert musical moment in F minor. And we'll just talk about it when we're done.
Here we go. Thank you.
Thank you. I just have to say, there's something about the way Schubert writes this piece with the leather hammer that. And of course, how did he know to voice it like that? Because I would have voiced it like this. Which is dead in the water, like that. He knew to give you one note here and two here, which is the rhythm guitar. Right?
Yes.
And it's so compelling, it forces the melody to emerge, right? It's like it's, you know.
You're definitely set up for something.
You know, and he probably wrote this in about 10 minutes, you know.
No, probably.
Because he was as close as we've ever had to an automatic writer, you know.
Yeah.
He was a medium.
Rip these things off at parties, and sometimes they were getting written down, and sometimes I suspect they did not.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it may well. And my guess is that this was some kind of Viennese, some kind of folk dance that he heard and then tweaked it up. So maybe it started like this, but then he added all the amazing stuff in the middle that makes it come to something, right? So anyway, we're so glad he took the time in his 31 years, right, of living.
So. Packed in a lot. Speaking of packing in a lot, what's inside this instrument?
There is the action.
We'll do a little play-by-play here. First, he takes off the music stand, and then a board.
Right.
And now we're taking out, it's almost like a drawer. You're just taking out a drawer here.
It is.
And what is that?
This is called the sled. And this raises the action up so it's close enough to the strings. But in order to get the action out, you have to take the sled out to lower it and then slide it out and hopefully not break off any hammers. Even though that wasn't the best sound. We'll see. I think we're still alive. Yeah. Good. So, and then this is the action. See if we can get it to rest up here. So it's a 5-octave instrument. You can, you know, it's a high F to a low F with middle C right in the middle, like that. And I'm going to do this first before I take the key out. You can kind of see that if I just touch the key, the hammer goes crazy. It's a hair trigger mechanism, and they could have designed it any way they wanted, but they went for speed. So everything in this is designed for. You know, the quickness of the hammer going to the string. So again, notice just a little bit of movement in the key creates a huge amount of movement in the hammer. It's a 10-to-1 ratio. We'll get one of these out of here.
Yikes.
I know. Some disassembly required. I always say, don't start this on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, right.
All right. Anyway, so this is the action. And again, it's a pivot in the middle. There's a fulcrum there where I'm holding it in the middle. I push on my end, and the back end of the key comes up like that. But nothing happens to the hammer until when the back end of the key is coming up, this little beak gets caught. There's another piece in there, and it flips the hammer toward the string. So this half inch here governs this nearly 5 inches here. That's why it's a 10-to-1 ratio. If these hammers weighed anything, I'd never be able to play this instrument because I'm at such a mechanical disadvantage. But because I'm at such a mechanical disadvantage, I have tremendous speed. So this is a speed mechanism instead of a power mechanism, which
it'll
modern piano
work.
Is a power mechanism.
I can tell you by looking at it, it'll never work.
It'll never work, right. Yeah. And this is the Germans, they changed the original Italian design. And this is really kind of the high German art of the 1750s, 60s, 70s. And this instrument is modeled after a Stein forte piano who built instruments for Mozart. And we know Mozart loved them. And again, there is the buckskin. That's the leather hammer. And you can see how small the hammers are. I think my lowest hammer here is probably smaller than the highest piano hammer on the modern piano. I mean, everything is very, very small scale. But again, that's just a couple of layers of leather. And the leather, being a skin, gives the sound. You notice the first thing you hear is kind of a consonant, a tick.
It's a percussion instrument.
A deer tick. Yes.
A deer tick.
A deer tick.
Pa-pum.
Yeah, exactly.
So here I thought you used it all up during the warm-up.
So anyway, and now the moment of truth is, can we get it back and play?
And why are the, if there is indeed a reason, are the key colors inverse to what we're accustomed to today?
So far as we know, it was a French 18th century taste thing. There were many keyboards before the 18th century that were the way we have them, with the white and black arrangement. the French 18th century, they liked to do this, kind of make the raised keys white and the long keys dark. And in the 18th century, it's sometimes called the triumph of French taste. I mean, the French really kind of, you know, they become the arbiters of taste in the 18th century. And so to look French was good, you know, and that's what happens. And then when you get to the 19th century, it goes back. It goes back to what we know. Put that on there, the desk.
Make sure there are no parts left out here.
I know, always a handful of bolts at the end. And then we'll see if it'll float. So that
back in business.
That incredible, you know, speed of the mechanism and combined with the leather is what makes these fine articulations possible. And my conversion to all of this was really through the humor that is possible with the forte piano. I'd seen Mozart operas when I was a kid, and I found them just so funny, but I couldn't make the modern piano laugh like that. I couldn't make it giggle like that. And when I heard this, the forte piano, when I was about 25 and playing with Mozart being played on it, it seemed to be a perfect fit for me. And so I thought next we would do something of the most uproarious type. This is kind
speaking of humor.
Yeah, this is Haydn, who is the funniest on the forte piano. And not only are the hammers leather, but the dampers are leather. So you hear the sound dries out. And I think in comedy, it's really the timing after the joke is told. It's the millisecond after the joke is told in which it happens, right? And I think that's what this is hopefully plugging into, you know. Yeah. So this is Haydn at his most hilarious.
And what is it?
Sonata in F major. I would say kind of what the chambermaid just saw, you know.
Why didn't they come up with better titles?
Yeah, what the chambermaid just saw. I wish. All right. So here we go. Thank you. Now thank you. Thank you very much. Now that's silly. That is so silly. Right, yeah.
It does conjure images, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a screwball comedy from the 30s, right? Hepburn and Cary Grant just, I don't know what they were on, right?
Can they move that fast? I'm not sure.
So that, and I think Haydn is to the forte piano probably what Debussy is to the modern. I mean, this really is his home court. It's very nimble, right? You notice also that the highs and the lows, there's a very strong split across the middle of the instrument between the incredible intelligence of the male voice down here. Right?
I can't wait to see where this is going.
Right. Like that, right. It's very woofy in the bass, like that versus the sparkling wit of the upper register. So
thank you for getting us out of that.
I know, exactly. Okay. So there's always a dialogue going on between these two zones, and really there's almost five zones. I mean, that's the clarino, and versus that's only one octave lower, but it sounds like four or five octaves lower on the modern piano. And then again, the male thing. Suddenly, it's oh, right? Yeah, it's just what we do our best, right? And then. Just ludicrous in the bottom octave. Yeah. And very, very dark. Yeah.
Very different characteristics, unlike a modern piano.
Right.
Those ranges have very different, I don't know if you call it timbres exactly.
Right, but, and the modern voices. Piano is designed to be homogenous so that when you play your 12-note chords in Debussy, you get this beautiful cloud, poof, like that. But this is designed almost to be not homogenous so that the characters really interact. They really dialogue with each other, and so it's. I think it's a dramatic instrument. It really is wedded to the 18th century sense of theater. You know?
So what happens if you take a more modern composer like Mendelssohn and apply this sound to something that he wrote?
Right. We'll do this one short one here, which is the Venetian Boat Song, and he starts in the super low register to give you a sense of the kind of the water, and maybe it's the evening is coming on and the sun is setting, and then you'll hear the gondolier singing on top of that in again a different register in the middle of the instrument, and then perhaps even a female choir is coming in on top of that as well. So the Mendelssohn Gondolier Song. Sometimes I call it the bipolar forte piano because, I mean, after the Haydn was so giddy and so, you know, effervescent and all that, you can see how that dark quality of the lower register, Mendelssohn is using it here to give you a sense of foreboding like that and, you know, watch out and hang on to your wallet. It's like, and then these wires here are in the bass are plain. They're brass strings without any covering on them. And that, so combined with the leather hammer, I think gives that great sense of undertow in the bottom. It's a wonderful piece. It's hard to believe he can have a beginning, a middle, and an end like that in two pages.
So. A little mini drama.
Yeah.
Frédéric Chopin did not write for the fortepiano, did he, Trevor?
Oh, he did.
Did he really?
He was a young, when he was a young man, these instruments would have been everywhere. They had built a lot of them in the late 18th century. So this sound would have been in his home instrument and things like that. Just as he's a young man, is the instrument beginning to get bigger and heavier. But even throughout Chopin's lifetime, he never heard anything like what the modern piano is today. Nothing that big or just, that opaque in its sound, They were, as you go back into the 18th century, they become more and more transparent. And so I thought we'd look at a couple of mazurkas, which are always Chopin looking back to his childhood. I mean, he writes them throughout his life, but they're always letters to the past and going back to his earliest dances. And apparently when he played them, he would put in loads of ornamentation and he was very free with them. And nobody could figure out how the rhythm that was printed on the page could be reconciled with the rhythm that he was actually playing. It was in a true Polish accent, So anyway, I thought we would just do a couple of these. One from Opus 24, the G minor from Opus 24, and then the B flat major from Opus 7, which he actually would have written when he was still in Poland.
Two mazurkas.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well,
did you like the entrance of the Sultan?
Well,
there?
I was going to say, yeah.
I know.
Yes.
And he goes off into G flat major there. I mean, which is in the tuning of the time, that was the most distant key from C major, so it's the most exotic, right? And filled with these strange scales. And Chopin actually says that the pedal is one pedal to be sustained throughout that passage. You never change it like that. And in the first mazurka I played, there was a passage too of like six bars, also with all these tonic dominant harmony crosses with one pedal like that. But on the forte piano, because the sound dies faster, you can get away with that. The smearing is actually charming. If you did that on the modern, it would be really obtuse, you know, in your face. But here, you can feather it out. So it's spooky, isn't it?
More little two-minute music dramas.
Right.
We don't know exactly what's going on, but something dramatic.
And in the middle of this is kind of the middle school, junior high school dance. It's conversation on the side of the dance floor type of thing. So
definitely some interesting things going on there.
Yeah. Wonderful piece.
Trevor, you mentioned that this fortepiano would have been an instrument of Beethoven.
Yes.
And right. Beethoven, we think of as one of those powerful players. So right. What does...
So what's going on?
Yeah, you know, how do those two reconcile?
What gives, right. You know, whether he was the recordings we don't have, right? So we don't know how loud he really played.
We know that he broke some strings, though.
Right. We know he broke some strings. He was also a great improviser. We know he was an amazing improviser. He would sit down in the evening and play for an hour or two, sometimes off the top of his head, like a jazzer, and move people to tears consistently with these orations from the instrument. And he, of course, arrives in Vienna around 1790 when Mozart is within a year of the end of his life. Beethoven, you know, studies a little bit with Haydn. He meets Mozart. And remember, Beethoven is from Bonn. He's from, you know, up in Germany, and he's moved to Vienna to try out his career. He's this amazing pianist and, again, amazing improviser, and is making a good living just playing concerts and beginning to publish. And this is the instrument he would have known. There would have been a few instruments slightly heavier than this in their build, but still the leather hammer and the transparent kind of 150-pound sound that we're hearing here. Of course, then in his late 20s, he starts getting a huge roaring in his ears, and by the time he's around 30, he can't hear much of anything, so he has to stop concertizing, and goes into his own head and writes the next 27 years of his life in his head, you know.
Perhaps remembering the sound of this instrument.
And apparently gave him pianos, great big pianos with four strings per note, and, you know, apparently he could bang and hear something. But yeah, I think it was mostly created from what his sound world was, you know, and then he morphed it into a new world. And I thought we'd do one from the period where he still could hear, and when he was still playing, and this probably was an improvisation of some sort, which is the middle movement of the Pathetique Sonata, and then the finale. Of course, another thing that Beethoven, his other, I think, great legacy is the string quartet. Nobody wrote string quartets like Beethoven. And I think on the forte piano, you can hear the string quartet more. Maybe because of all those different strata that are out here, you can hear the violin and the second violin and the viola and the cello all talking to each other, which I enjoy very much doing on here. Anything else about the man?
Let's see what he sounds like.
So this is, again, and this is in the key of A flat, this middle movement. In the tuning of the day, C major was the most harmonious of all keys, and the further you went away from C, the more you get more, you know, kind of vibrato in the sound. And kind of a male choir earnestness to the sound. So A flat is definitely in the male choir zone.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you get more of a sense of a little opera going on with the voices so much clearer, more distinct and individual.
Right. And they're pushing off of each other, I think. And I always hear a little bit of flamenco guitar too in it, too. There's something about the, you know, the 10 million notes per second kind of thing.
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah, it really very fizzy like that. And I hope you could hear the string quartet. I mean, I think it's apparent throughout. What a wonderful piece of music. And anyway, so that's some early Beethoven, the Pathetique.
Well, can you take us out with one more?
Yes, we'll just get right to it.
Okay. Yeah, so I think you said there's a fascinating minuet in D.
Right. This is the minuet in D where nobody can believe it's Mozart. It was placed in front of me kind of blind once and somebody said, "Who wrote this?" And I read it for the first time. I had no idea. So enjoy some of Mozart and Duke Ellington's modulations together. The minuet in D by Mozart. For years, this was on my answering machine as I'm not home right now. See if you can
pick that out.
So it's hard to, Mozart was definitely with alcohol assisting him, right? Very strange chords, and they're like that, yeah. Even Shostakovich might.
Right? Well, we know that Mozart liked punch.
Yeah, exactly, right. Very, almost like sliding sounds going on in the piece, right? It's the pitch bending going on is what I think he said. Maybe it's a street serenade kind of a thing right there.
So if I wanted to give one of these to somebody for Christmas.
Right, where do you get a fortepiano?
Yeah, where do you
get
one?
Right, so there are two ways, right? One is with there are companies that make kits of these, and again, you know, don't start the day that you want to finish it. Right? There's still a lot of parts to put together. This is, again, homemade, and bit by bit, Norman Shepherd made every part in this, except I guess the wire was made in England. But it's one of a kind, you know. So those are the two ways.
And, of course, Trevor Stevenson is one of a kind, too. And thanks for joining me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
A pleasure. And thanks also to Stephanie Elkins and Ramona Gasper back there in the FM studio, and to our engineer, Brittany True. And you can hear this on Wisconsin Public Television in a couple of months. We'll tell you how. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.